Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan. Today I'm in conversation with Frances Adamson, Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Before her present job, Ms. Adamson was International Advisor to Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. After serving as Australia's Ambassador in Beijing between 2011 and 2015. This podcast is a collaboration between the Australian Strategic Policy Institute and The Conversation. Frances Adamson, can I start by asking what you see as the biggest current issues in Australian foreign policy?
Well, Michelle, I think I'd probably start, and you won't be at all surprised by this, with reference to the government's foreign policy white paper published in November 2017. And that really laid out, I think, the key challenges grouped under some headings. And that's an important reference point for me. And I think most of the things I'd expect us to talk about today really relate back in one way or another to, firstly, a peaceful, stable and prosperous Indo-Pacific, and then secondly, the work that we do, because we are the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, in terms of trying to create the right conditions for Australian companies to do well. This all links into our national prosperity, but it relates directly to some of the headwinds we're encountering in terms of global protectionism and the international trading system. We have a further objective of keeping Australians safe, secure and free, and much of the work that the department does we do in collaboration with other departments also, and it relates in many areas to counter-terrorism but a whole range of other issues. And then, of course, there's a whole set of issues around what we call a rules-based order or the rules-based system and various challenges to that that we're seeing. And finally, the fifth one is our step up, if you like, in the South Pacific, and of course that includes our relations with Timor-Leste.
We'll look at some of these in detail later, but how different are the challenges for Australian foreign policy compared with, say, the 1980s when you started your career?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Of course, it's very hard when you're comparing periods of time 30 plus years apart to be truly objective about it. I mean, I've always found my work and the work of my colleagues, the work of the department, to be challenging, to be relevant, to be consequential. I'd have to say, though, while it's hard perhaps to be objective oneself, a number of colleagues and former colleagues have taken the view publicly, I think Alan Gingell is one of them, that the issues that we're facing at the moment are perhaps of an altogether different order of magnitude. Now, be that as it may, it's always been, as I say, interesting and consequential work. But I think if we look at the process of globalisation over the last 30 years, increasing use of technology, the shift of economic and strategic weight to this region, I think you could make a reasonable case that it's a pretty interesting and challenging time, and that what we in this department do matters. Of course, much of what we do with colleagues from a wide range of departments. And I think whole of government has taken on a new meaning, one a deeper meaning than it had 30 years ago.
The rather fractious state of Australia-China relations is getting a good deal of attention at the moment. How severe do you think these tensions are? And are they worse than at any time in the recent past?
I think there are always ups and downs in our relationship with China. And I know people are keen to get some kind of objective benchmark. I think, and we're meeting the day after the Australia-China Business Council's annual China Networking Day held up at Parliament House. And the Prime Minister talked about the continuing strengthening and deepening of our relationship with China.
But the Chinese ambassador was rather sharper.
Well, actually, I wasn't there in the room when the Chinese ambassador gave his speech. I've read the whole speech. And actually, I thought it was a rather balanced account of our relationship with some positives in there. He used a couple of adjectives which have naturally enough received attention. But from my point of view, this is a relationship that matters greatly to both of us. We will in the future encounter areas of difference between us. The challenge is how we manage that. But in many, many respects, this is a relationship which is fundamentally sound and which I think has a great deal of potential. And it's clear to me that both governments attach priority to ensuring that it's able to move forward on a very sound footing.
What's the current situation on visas for ministers, as you understand it?
Well, this has received, to me, what is a surprising amount of attention, because there have been no problems with visas for ministers, at least certainly not that I am aware of. And the issue really with official visits to China, visits by ministers, by senior officials, it's not so much the visa. I mean, for example, I have a 3-year multiple re-entry visa. It is more an agreement on what is described by the Chinese as a mutually convenient time, a time when they are ready to receive us and a time that is suitable for us to visit. So the visa issue has really...
That's sort of a visa by another name, though.
Well, no, it's not really. I mean, I think the fact is that there is a considerable high-level interaction between both countries, and of course not everything needs to happen in Australia or China. There are a large number of multilateral meetings where ministers will meet their Chinese counterparts in the normal course of business. But I would expect there to be, in the coming months, some visits from China, and that Australian ministers will be visiting China as well. So I think there shouldn't be the degree of concern that there seems to be about high-level visits. There is quite a deal of high-level interaction, and there will be more visits in future.
Do you think that if the Prime Minister wanted to visit in the next few months, there would be a mutually convenient time?
I can certainly envisage a time when it will be convenient for the Prime Minister to visit, but as is always the case with the highest level visits, there is a substantial preparatory lead-in time. And I think you could say we've started that process, but I would expect it to take some time because there is simply a lot of work to be done. But I'm confident that the Prime Minister will visit China again. Of course, the Foreign Minister will visit beforehand for the foreign and strategic dialogue, but it wouldn't be sensible for me to nominate a time because so many other things, not least the availability, the travel of leaders in both countries.
But you would expect the Prime Minister to get there before the election?
I would certainly expect that the Prime Minister would get there before the election, as long as the Chinese are willing to receive him and he's able to travel. Of course, he can't travel during parliamentary sitting periods, but it's part of my job as a diplomat to ensure that he can.
Now, what about your own visits? I think you told the one of the Senate hearings that mutually convenient times hadn't been found on a couple of occasions. Have you sorted out a visit?
Yes, I visited towards the end of May, and it had, again, something that perhaps received rather more attention than it should have. They'd suggested initially that I visit in January, their suggestion invitation. We tried it February, Chinese New Year, and then other commitments on the Chinese side made that difficult. But in fact, when we met in late May, my host said, your visit is overdue.
Now, we mentioned the China-Australia Business Forum yesterday and the Chinese ambassador's speech. In that speech, he reiterated that China never interferes in the internal affairs of another country. As a former ambassador to Beijing, what is your response to that proposition?
Well, I think my first response is that, of course, countries shouldn't interfere in other countries, and in fact it's been a matter of very long-standing Chinese policy to, in fact, they have a policy of non-interference in the affairs of other countries. But I think if we think about this, we've had our own debate in a slightly different context about the difference between influence, and I think it's widely understood that influence is the normal work of diplomats. We seek to persuade others to our points of view wherever we are in the world. But I think we've all agreed through a conversation about this that the difference between influence and interference is that interference is often corrupt, coercive, or covert, and that's what distinguishes it. So I think we certainly welcome any reiteration of a Chinese policy of non-interference, I think we need to be careful about what we mean by this, and I think we need to to some extent to take the Chinese at their word, but also to deepen a conversation about what we each mean by interference, because of course we work very willingly and actively with the Chinese as partners in many parts of the world beyond our bilateral relationship regionally and globally. But these are matters for each country to sort out in their own bilateral relationship. And of course, in our case, it's one of the reasons why the government broadly has moved down the path of developing legislation to help us counter foreign interference wherever it may come from.
Well, on that legislation, the Lowy Institute poll, which came out this week, found that only a minority of Australians, 41%, saw foreign interference as a critical threat, was well behind terrorism, climate change, and the threat of a severe global downturn. Do you think that we've been too complacent for too long about the growth of this interference threat?
That we as Australians have been complacent? Look, I think it's, when you mentioned some of the other threats, counter-terrorism, I think perhaps before 9/11, Australians were not necessarily as aware before the Bali bombings of the impact of terrorism. Similarly, I think it's taken a while for people to understand what the impacts of climate change might be. So I wouldn't necessarily think that we've been slow to come to this point, but I think having reached this point, it's obvious that the government has felt that it has an obligation to act, and that's exactly what it's doing.
Do you feel that our universities are becoming too dependent on Chinese students? Because obviously, when we talk about interference, that is one forum where many people see pressure on students. But from the point of view of the universities, they have become increasingly financially dependent, not just on Chinese students, but foreign students generally, but particularly Chinese students.
Well, I think if you look across the board at the university sector, obviously there's been a very substantial growth in the number of international students, as you say, from across the board. They've come in significantly larger numbers from India and from China, and we've encouraged that, of course. And I think campuses across Australia have been enriched by having foreign students studying alongside students from Australia. Whether any particular university is overly dependent on students from one country or another is really a matter for them to decide. But I think it's not so much the numbers. I think it's the ways in which our universities, and I know our vice chancellors have been very active in this, in setting standards, ensuring that there is transparency around arrangements. So I wouldn't myself think that there was any particular level beyond which we should not go, but these are matters essentially for vice-chancellors. What I see from the perspective of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade is a deepening of our people-to-people relationships, not only through the contributions of inbound students, but through the now 30-plus thousand Australian students who've travelled overseas in connection with the new Colombo plan.
Julie Bishop, in a moment of great frankness the other day, said absolutely she needed a bigger foreign aid budget. We're giving aid to the Solomon Islands to prevent that country using Huawei for a communication cable. Should we be substantially expanding our spending on aid in the Pacific, given the Chinese footprint?
Well, as the Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, you'd hardly expect me to disagree with my minister if she says we absolutely need an increase in our aid budget, then I would certainly agree with that, but that's in a very general sense. Let me just start with the communications, the undersea cable project that you referred to. And there I just want to be clear that the purpose of the project and the purpose of Australia providing assistance, we have an undersea cable task force in this department now working both with Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea, is to give them a piece of very high quality infrastructure, which I think will be absolutely transformative for the people of Papua New Guinea and the people of Solomon Islands. To be connected with high speed internet to the World Wide Web will enable their digital economies to develop in a way that really has been held back by either very slow 3G or in some cases no access to the internet at all. So just let me be clear that that is the purpose of our assistance. Secondly, though, in relation to the South Pacific, I think the government announced in this year's budget that we would be spending $1.3 billion or allocating $1.3 billion to the South Pacific in our aid budget this year. Now, that's an all-time high, but that's because there are very substantial challenges there across the board. And if you look at the Sustainable Development Goals. Many of them have not been met in South Pacific countries, in Pacific Island countries. Many of these are very small island states, quite fragile economies, very dependent often on remittances from seasonal workers in Australia or workers in other countries in the region, including New Zealand. So there's a vulnerability there.
And that's been there for a long time.
It has been there.
What has changed, though, is that China has become more active.
Look, a number of donors are more active in the Pacific, and we welcome that. And the Foreign Minister has been very clear that we are very happy indeed to encourage further Chinese assistance in the South Pacific. We need to be able to work alongside the Chinese. In some cases, as we are in Papua New Guinea on an anti-malarial project, we will actually work with the Chinese. But the point we're keen to make, and this is a point we make wherever the assistance comes from, is that we want it to be provided transparently. We want the costs of that assistance, if you like, where it's soft loans, to be apparent. We want it not to create an unsustainable debt burden. Bear in mind, of course, all of Australia's aid, wherever it goes, is in the form of grants. This is not aid which is to be repaid. So there are different kinds of aid, and what we're concerned to ensure, and we work very much with our South Pacific neighbours, is that the aid that they receive is for projects that they regard as highly desirable, and that it's provided on a basis that actually increases their productive capacity.
Let's turn now to the Singapore summit. Experts have widely different interpretations of the outcome. What's your readout?
I think what I'd say at the moment is that it's really too soon to tell. Of course, it was an historic moment when President Trump met, I think we now call him Chairman Kim, but it's not something that I would have predicted 6 months ago. I can be very clear about that. I think what we're all focused on, obviously, is the need for denuclearization of North Korea, and that means complete, verifiable and irreversible denuclearization. And much of the commentary has been helpfully actually on the part of experts in this subject area. They've seen similar undertakings made in the past, and they've also seen very little of any lasting action was taken. So I think when I say it's too soon, we simply need to see, and I know the Americans have already signalled, and the Secretary of State and officials are already starting to work through the detail. It will take months and years before we really know whether this is as historic in its implementation as it was in the moment.
Are you optimistic or sceptical?
I think I'm very cautiously optimistic.
Now, obviously, President Trump and Chairman Kim have different styles to the more usual styles of international leaders. Australia talks a lot about the rules-based international order, but increasingly we're really seeing international politics operating in a quite other fashion, aren't we? That the rules-based order is being put aside by leaders like this, and they're going at things in a different way. Do you think this notion has now been passed by history?
I think it's a good question to ask, and again, I think it is too soon really to say. I mean, we identified this in the Foreign Policy White Paper as a very significant challenge. It certainly feels like a very significant challenge, if I can put it that way. But Australia's interests are overwhelmingly served as a country which is, the world's 14th largest economy. We are best served by an international order where disputes are settled in accordance with international law and where there are rules governing trading arrangements and other things. So it's overwhelmingly in our interest to seek to uphold. That doesn't mean without change. There may be areas where, change is a good thing. So we shouldn't regard this order, if you like, as set in concrete, but our interests are best served by continuing to ensure that it is able to strengthen in areas where perhaps it's been probed and found to be weak.
But are we now in a more ad hoc era?
I think there are examples of what you might call ad hocery, but I also think there is a deeper basis of rules about which we must not be remotely complacent and on which we will need to build. But I am not writing it off, and in fact, we are doing everything we can to ensure that it survives and prospers.
Do you think it's likely that under President Trump, the US will substantially withdraw from the Asia-Pacific region, and what would the consequences for Australia be?
I don't think that's likely. That may not be what you're expecting me to say, but I don't actually think that's likely. And I heard Secretary of Defence Jim Mattis deliver a speech at the Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore at the beginning of June, in which he reiterated a very strong US commitment to the Indo-Pacific, to enduring engagement in the Indo-Pacific. Obviously had a focus on the military dimension of this, but I think there is plenty of evidence that the US, while it might be going about its business in some respects in ways that we haven't seen before, I think its interests are overwhelmingly engaged in the region, including economically. And where those interests are engaged, I would expect to see the United States want to continue to defend those interests, if I can put it that way.
Julie Bishop said the other day, and I quote, "With the US fighting Canada and making friends with North Korea, who can make sense of what's going on?" How difficult is it for Australian foreign policymakers, including departmental officials, to keep up with US foreign policy under President Trump? And can we assume that Australia is in a special category among America's allies, perhaps a different category to Canada?
How hard is it to keep up? I think we've had to make some adjustments, obviously, in our expectations and in practical ways in our diplomacy over the last 18 months or so. I mean, that's obvious. But I think we've got rather used to concepts of disruption wherever they come from. And I think one of the things that Malcolm Turnbull's done as Prime Minister really from day one is emphasise the importance of agility and to emphasise the importance of innovative approaches, and we've had to deploy a few of those. But of course we have a deep and long-lasting relationship with the United States, and you know, Joe Hockey's 100 years of mateship has got quite a lot of prominence. At the centenary of the Battle of Hamel on the 4th of July is coming up, so we fought with them in every battle. That still counts for something, of course it does.
And across, we're dealing with two deal makers here, President, Prime Minister.
Well, I won't comment on that.
Self-styled deal makers.
I won't comment on that, but what I've seen is the two of them able to work with very effectively with each other, and we will need to continue to do that. But we also, Australia is a very substantial investor in the United States, about $100 billion worth. I think it has created many, many jobs, put that at about 100,000 jobs, I think. So we've got very substantial investments. We also happen to have a trade deficit with the United States. And so it's way over $100 billion our investment, but we've got a trade deficit as well. We're very like-minded in many things, and deeper values between our people and the people-to-people connections. So I won't be remotely complacent about our relationship with our alliance partner, but I think we've shown over the last 18 months that we can both make it work.
To come back to the Lowy poll, and I quote it, it says, "There is no question that Donald Trump's presidency has eroded Australians' trust and confidence in the United States as a responsible global actor. That trust has fallen to its lowest point in the poll's history." It should also be noted, however, that the poll found support for the alliance had held. But is this erosion of trust a serious problem, or do you think it's just a passing phenomenon?
I think if you, and the Lowy poll, of course, is a very valuable source of information on a wide range of issues. And I think it's been going now for 14 years, and its data is now starting to be able to demonstrate what we know to be the case, which is that there are ups and downs in our relationships, and that particularly, I have to say, I think there's probably been more volatility in the poll when it relates to the United States over a number of years. But I think it keeps coming back to a central point of valuing, as you say, the alliance, and other things can be a bit more volatile.
Now, the US has just pulled out of the United Nations Human Rights Council, a body that Australia fought very hard to get on, fought successfully. The government has said it's disappointed by the American decision. What effect do you think that decision will have?
Well, I would expect it to be a source of disappointment around the world, actually, to see the United States withdraw from the Human Rights Council. Human rights matter greatly. While I heard and understood the rationale for the withdrawal, I think we would always say, and countries like ours would always say, that it is much more important to be at the table and to express one's views. And of course, as with all international institutions, they really only work as well as members believe that there is value in participating in them. So I think we will now need to bear a heavier load. So will other members of the council. We are very disappointed in it. We have a deeper shared values with the United States when it comes to human rights. We hope, as with some other fora from which they've withdrawn, that at some point they will be back again. But for now, we are not holding back and expressing our disappointment.
Were we consulted at all in that decision?
I think it was a matter for the United States, but of course we...
Sounded out.
Well, I don't know about sounded out. It had certainly been a matter of conversations. We'd expressed our views over a period of time, as we would in any international organisation which the US is a member and fulfilling
a role. So we tried to persuade them not to take this decision.
I think we expressed our view that the Human Rights Council would remain a stronger organisation with United States participation.
Now, we've spoken a lot about China, but what's the state of our diplomatic dialogue at the moment with Russia, given the planes downing and Russia's lack of cooperation in the aftermath of that?
I describe our relationship with Russia at the moment as functional. One needs to have functional relationships across the board, no matter what differences there are. But of course, we have had a number of differences over important matters with Russia, and for Australia, for the Foreign Minister in particular, but for the Australian government, of course, the responsibility for or holding the perpetrators of the downing of MH17 to account, of course, is very high up on our list, but so too Ukraine, so too the Skripal response. Of course, we expelled two Russian diplomats, and in response, the Russians expelled two of our diplomats. So there is, you know, we are working on smaller embassies. We would always work with the Russians where we have common interests, but it's become harder to find areas of common interest.
At the weekend, the Liberal Federal Council passed a resolution saying that our embassy in Israel should be moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. The government's rejected that, but given the position of the Americans on this, is it likely to become Australian policy in the longer term?
I don't think so.
Not at any point?
I think Australian governments, I would expect Australian governments in future to maintain the position that Jerusalem is a final status issue. Embassy will remain in Tel Aviv.
And do you think it's counterproductive that the Americans have made that move to the general situation in the Middle East?
I think it's not been helpful.
What could be the ramifications?
Well, look, none of these things should really be seen in isolation, and we need to yet see what effort the Americans will put into a Middle East peace process. But I think from all sides, it simply made what was already a very, very difficult process even harder.
Now, DFAT's been squeezed for resources over the years compared with, for example, Defence, which has received massive extra resources. You're always being asked, it seems, to do more with less. Is the department struggling to do what it needs to do as the diplomatic face of a middle power?
That sounds like a very friendly question, Michelle. Look, we could always do with budget increases. I don't think you'd find any departmental secretary in Canberra who would tell you otherwise. What we've managed to do, though, and we have received some additional funding from government, including in the most recent budget, we've been able to expand our diplomatic footprint. In fact, this government, since 2013, has presided over the largest expansion of our diplomatic footprint ever. But there are pressures, of course there are. We've got a very, very big agenda, and of course we have responsibility not only for foreign policy and trade policy, trade negotiations, but also for our development assistance program. So it's a very, very busy agenda. What the white paper has done is give us a new frame and focus, not a dramatically different one, but we need to be absolutely clear about how we're going to deploy our resources in keeping with what the government has said to us are our highest priorities. Now, that's what we're doing. I've restructured the department. It's true that we've had staff reductions and budget reductions, and that they principally relate to the efficiency dividend. But can we do much more? I think we're just about at our limit.
And, of course, a few years ago, AusAid came into the department. Mm. How was that swallowing accomplished, and how's it going now?
Well, I was overseas at the time, but I must say, coming back to the department in 2016, I was hugely impressed at how well it had gone, and hugely impressed actually with the diversity of our colleagues and the skills that they had. Look, I think there was unhappiness on the part of some people very early on. But I'd like to think that this has been a very successful machinery of government change. That doesn't mean that there aren't issues that still arise and need to be dealt with. Of course that's the case. And in terms of our growing capability, I am very much at pains in wanting to ensure that all of my colleagues within the department, and indeed others outside it, know that we have to attach, and I personally do as secretary, a really high priority to the maintenance of aid capability. We need everyone to understand. We don't want them necessarily walking away from the aid work that they've been doing so well for many years and perhaps taking on another, what we call capability anchor. We want them to keep at it. I want them to know that it's valued, because it was a really, from my point of view, and I think from Australia's national interest point of view, it was a very well-founded decision to bring aid, foreign policy and trade together. It gives us tools that not every government has, and the way we're able to work those together, I think, gives us more impact and more influence in our part of the world.
We've talked a lot of international politics, but of course one issue that is very big in the world, very threatening in the world today, is the rise of protectionism. What's your prognosis on this for the next few years? Do you think that we're really in for a bad time with trade wars?
This is probably the issue on which I think I'm personally most gloomy, I have to say. I mean, I'm an economist by training. This department's work is around removal of trade barriers. For a country like Australia, we absolutely have to have free and open trading arrangements and barriers reduced, not only in tariffs, but new markets opening for services, non-tariff measures being removed. That's how you grow economies. That's how you create jobs. It's how you create a prosperous Indo-Pacific region. But the winds of protectionism are indeed strengthening, and we have always been very strong supporters of and contributors to the World Trade Organization. That organization is under a great deal of pressure, indeed threat at the moment, and one of the big challenges for our diplomacy is to ensure that it's able to rise to the challenges and not, as some would rather have it, be cast to one side.
But is anyone listening to us?
Well, our job is to ensure that people do. There are plenty of what we would call like-mindeds around the place, but there are challenges. And we've already done some very innovative work on digital trade and e-commerce within the World Trade Organization, but there are some particular issues that we want to work on, including when it comes to transparency and the dispute settlement mechanism. Some of this is quite technical, of course, but we've got, I think, some of the world's best trade negotiators in this department. And if anyone can ensure that it has a happy ending, they will be able to.
Frances Adamson, thank you so much for talking with us today. And thank you to my podcast producer, Eliza Burlage. That's all for now. Goodbye.